The Trump administration has been in office about 6 months now, and joining us to talk about that is Ron Fauché, political analyst and publisher of Lunchtime Politics. Ron, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Happy to be here.
So, Ron, you wrote an opinion piece marking the six-month anniversary of Donald Trump's second term in office, his second presidency. What are the polls saying about the job that he's doing?
Well, the polls are saying he's, you know, his average approval rating at this point, pardon me, I'm fighting off a cold here, to be about 46%. And that's an important number for Donald Trump because that's the popular vote he received in 2016. And just about the popular vote he received in 2017, so or rather in 2020. So his popularity has been remarkably stable over the last 10 years. And even though since he's been president, he started off this time in the 50s, he went down into the mid 40s again, which is where he is now.
And when you make that correlation to the popular vote, if you would, for the benefit of the listening audience,
sure.
That's important because of the electoral college in an election process, right?
Right, because, you know, the of course, the electoral vote is what matters in terms of who gets elected president. But the popular vote gives you a sense of what the political strength was of the candidate who won, the total number of votes they received, and it definitely relates somewhat to the electoral vote. But you know, when Trump won this past time and he won the popular vote, I think he felt sort of vindicated with it.
It's interesting. So let's talk on a little bit more granular level. Obviously, they come off the heels now of just passing the big, beautiful bill. From my perspective, that has really become almost a marketing nightmare for them in many respects. I would have thought they would have had a messaging campaign a lot stronger around the accomplishments of the bill. As opposed to what I've seen thus far. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree with you. You know, the big, beautiful bill basically makes the Republicans in the Trump administration responsible for just about everything. And of course, they should be responsible for just about everything. Just like when the Democrats were in power, they should be responsible. But politically, it makes it more difficult for them to blame anything now on the Biden administration, particularly as it relates to, number one, the economy, and number two, Medicaid. And look, and there's some popular things in that bill, as you pointed out. But usually when you're dealing with a package of issues like that, they have to rise and fall on the weakest link. And if the weakest link is not popular, the whole thing is. Remember, when President Biden had his Inflation Reduction Act, it had little to do with inflation, but that's what they called it, and it sort of made a mockery of his efforts to fight inflation, and took the, you know, it gave him full responsibility for everything he was doing with the economy, and of course the Democrats paid the price in the presidential election last year because of that.
Yeah, there are a number of provisions in there actually that Democrats would have supported, you know, money for the air transportation system to bring up the technology to more contemporary standards, things of that nature. Obviously, they've had some horrible, tragic events that symbolizes the need to spend some money there and make improvements. But
sure.
I, you know, it's kind of interesting the way that this is rolled out. Let's pivot to tariffs. You know, you and I have talked about this a lot with Donald Trump. He oversells a lot of times. You know, I'll get this, that, and this, and that accomplished in the first 30 days on day one. I'll resolve this on, you know, day 20, this. Always selling himself short on time. And he ultimately accomplishes some of what he actually promises. It may take a little longer. And it looks like that's what's going to happen here with tariffs.
Yeah, I think so. Although, even though he put tariffs way up and then he pulls them down, puts them way up, pulls them down. I think it's, you know, it's really part of his strategy. And the strategy is to tell other countries, hey, we've got the economic power and you have to negotiate with us whether you like to or not. And I think that can work. It is working here and there. They apparently made a lot of progress with Japan the other day. But the problem he has with tariffs is the American people see a direct link between high tariffs and high prices. And if there is another, coming back with more inflation and high domestic prices, the American people are going to blame the tariffs for them. And politically, that's going to be, if that happens, as disastrous for the Republicans as it was for the Democrats during Biden's administration.
Yeah, and only time will tell on that front as well. As you said, I think it's the strategy. He starts out high, ends up getting to a number that he probably always had within his mindset as to where he was going to settle out on these issues. Interesting, though, there were doomsday predictions about what was going to happen in the first 2 weeks as some of these tariffs were changed. We hadn't seen it.
No, and I think the market has basically adjusted his way of doing things on the tariffs. They're not taking the stock market, they're not taking every statement he makes, every move he makes seriously until it's really locked in. And fortunately for the market, that is the case. Because what he's doing now, oftentimes doesn't have a big effect. And when it looks like he's pulling back or slowing down, the market tends to go up because it may be better than what they've already baked in. So, essentially that's worked out, I think, favorably for the economy. But as he would say, we'll have to see where it goes and which countries are going to work with the U.S., negotiate deals and how those deals ultimately work.
Yeah. Immigration. He campaigned hard on that issue. He did so the first time around. He did it again the second time around. He moved very quickly in the issuance of executive orders. He moved very quickly in the cancellation of orders that were put in place by the previous administration under President Joe Biden. And this has become very controversial across this country. Where does it play out for him?
Well, at this stage of the game, it's his best issue in terms of public opinion. People believe that immigration and border security was one of the most important reasons to vote for Donald Trump in the elections last year. And they voted for him for that. And as you just laid out, he acted on it. He did it. And by all the data that's come out, it seems to be working in terms of the actual issue of border security. Now, a lot of people are complaining about the cruelty of some of the things that are involved and mistakes that are being made and how you treat families and that sort of thing. But he can make a case that they have either stopped or significantly lowered the illegal entries, and that the U.S. has effectively taken control of the problem, which is what many voters wanted to do. Now, how he does it and how he handles it from here on out is another issue. I know a lot of people are hoping that he uses his credibility on the issue. And by the way, the polls on it do show his approval on immigration has gone down some, although it still remains, his, generally speaking, when you look at all the polls, his best issue. But some people are hoping it leads to him coming up with a big immigration reform package that emphasizes both border security and sort of straightening out, you know, what happens to all of the other people who are not deported and who have jobs and businesses in the United States, and to see if there's some way that there could be a path to citizenship where you would essentially straighten out the issue and really take it off the boards as an important issue, because essentially it would be solved as a problem.
But that's kind of where the rub is, right? This path to citizenship. I mean, if the first step is an illegal step, Republicans don't want to reward individuals with a path, and Democrats, on the other hand, do. You know, the other thing is that. Go ahead.
Yeah, no. I was just going to say, I mean, the way you deal with that is you put a penalty in that somebody who came here illegally has to pay some kind of penalty, whether it's in terms of a dollar amount or, you know, a weekly or monthly penalty or however it could work any possible way, so that people aren't being rewarded for doing it. They have to pay a price for having done it, and then they can decide whether they want to stay here or go. But anyway, I do think he has options now if he wants to. You know, I think a lot of liberals see it as an opportunity for him to be a sort of a Nixon goes to China, where, you know, you have the tough guy on immigration coming up with a immigration solution that goes beyond just being tough on the border, but does at the same time accomplish being tough on the border. You know, we'll see if that happens at some point. But as it stands now, immigration is his best issue. And I know a lot of Democrats have trouble believing that, because they think a lot of what he's done has been wrong. But the American people wanted to close the border. They wanted to deal with it effectively, and many of them believe he's done it.
Yeah, no doubt. Let us pivot in the minutes that we have left. I know you've been watching what's going on relative to our illustrious mayor, LaToya Cantrell. This has been a very interesting 6 to 8 weeks here. I don't know how much worse it can get between now and January 11th, her last day in office, which happens to be my birthday, Ron. In case you're interested, what a great gift, right? The end of this term. Your thoughts about what's going on? I mean, this is crazy what's happening.
Well, I think a lot of people believe that she has essentially is essentially checked out as being mayor, in the sense that she's not getting involved in any new initiatives and is just kind of letting her term run out. And I don't know if that's true or not, but I know a lot of people in politics, many of whom were allies of her, believe that's what's going on. And so, you know, I guess if you look at it in that light, it's understandable. But I can tell you that, you know, the mayor's popularity rating is lower than it's ever been. It's down to about 27% now. And it wasn't that long ago. It was well in the 60s. But it's cratered over the last few years, yeah, a couple of years. And that's where it is. And it's just I don't know if she cares where she is in the polls. I have no idea. She may not. And I've heard that from a lot of people that she feels like people give her the short end of the stick and that they don't, rewarding her for her accomplishments. And so she just kind of threw up her hands. Now, that may not be true, but that's what people around City Hall are saying. And so now everybody's waiting to elect a new mayor and new city council and look to the future and go forth.
What impact does her administration right now, its failures, her personal failures, where she stands in the polling, have on the mayor's race?
Well, it potentially has impact because it sort of looms over the whole thing. It would be very difficult for anybody running for mayor to cozy up and look too close to the incumbent administration, because that would not be a popular place to be, position to run for mayor. Usually after people are tired, fed up, and don't like the political status quo, they reach out for change. And I think that's what we're having now, that people are looking for change, and they're looking for the best candidate who will offer change. And so usually the current mayor or our governor or president, for that matter, depending upon where they are in public esteem, they sort of lay out the have a big effect on the public mood. I think that's clearly the case here.
Yeah, I think at one point in time, maybe her closest ally on the council was Oliver Thomas. I mean, he made no bones about that. Obviously, it's hard running from the East. It's always been hard running from the East, right? It's a lot easier to develop a base in Mid-City and Broadmoor otherwise than it is from the East. And it seems as though he may have embraced her early on, said, I'm not so sure that's the case now.
Well, these council members have to deal with the mayor all the time on everything. And if it's not the mayor herself, it's, the key members of the mayor's administration. So every time they're doing something, they have to make that calculation. And one of the things that I've learned studying city government and mayors and the politics of mayoral elections is that mayors and city council really have to work together to get things done. And it's in the mayor's interest to work with the city council, just like it's in the city council's interest to work with the mayor, as long as they have a common agenda that's aligned. And that's usually the best way it works. And of course, we've seen, the current mayor and the current city council at odds on almost everything. And I think it makes it difficult to govern as mayor when you don't have the legislative body with you. And mayors should do everything they can to work with the council. Of course, Mayor Cantrell would say, well, she did, and the council was sniping at her, and they all wanted to run for other offices and what have you, so they'll blame one another. But when you see mayors and councils fighting, that's usually not good for the mayor.
Or the city. I always say the entity's interest always outweighs the individual's, and sometimes...
And that's always the most important thing.
Absolutely, no doubt. Ron, thank you so much for joining us today. I know you're a little bit under the weather. We really appreciate it. I hope you get well soon.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, folks, that's Ron Fauché, political analyst and publisher of Lunchtime Politics. We'll be right back, and when we do get back, we'll visit with Pat Connick, Louisiana State Senator, and we'll talk about some of the funding that he replaced for the city of Gretna that was taken away from the newly elected councilman in that district. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Pat Connick, Louisiana State Senator. Pat, welcome to the show.
Hey, good to be here. Neil, how are you?
Doing well. Pat, you announced the other day that you were able to backfill some dollars for the city of Gretna. The way that this happened was the previous councilman, Marion Edwards, had obligated funds for certain projects within the city limits. He decided to retire from office, and the incoming councilman, Kerner, deobligated those funds. A lot of the process to utilize those funds had been in place. You announced the other day that you saw the need to backfill that. So tell us about your line of thinking and what ultimately happened.
Yeah. No, what Gretna is doing is really something we need to support and back. And Oswego's trying to do the same thing, but Gretna's got it together. They have a great quality of life. They got a great atmosphere in that town. And I saw these cuts taking place, and it would have devastated the Gretna Fest, the BMX track, and the farmer's market. And why do that? So when that went down, I met with the mayor, and we got her up to Baton Rouge, and we found a way to scrape some money together to keep those things going. So I think we did good.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting when you talk about economic development that, you know, sometimes these wins are really hard to achieve. You put things in place, and then people want a Monday morning quarterback everything you've done. I kind of looked at the process. I don't understand exactly where the problems are, but the fact of the matter is that the projects that they've done so far, they've been successful. And they've kind of been the anchor for the West Bank. I mean, my office was not three blocks away from the city of Gretna. I saw it every day when I was there. I saw the improvement. I saw the growth. I saw a lot of good positive things happen there. It doesn't mean we always agree on every issue, because we didn't. But the fact of the matter, I always tried to give credit where credit was due, and I thought it was a shame. So I'm glad that you were able to backfill with these dollars so that they can bring these projects to a completion.
Yeah, I think the cuts did not make sense to me and many others. It only hurt the entire West Bank. And I think everybody realizes that a strong Gretna is a strong West Bank. You know, Gretna's attracted families and businesses. That farmer's market, you know, is a cool place to visit on a Saturday. I think it's one of the best in the city. And why stop that? Why take that away? And so working with Cameron Henry and the legislators, you know, we pulled the money together, and I took money from my project, the Hope Haven project, to help fund this, what was going on. So hopefully we can all get on the same page and work together for a unified West Bank and
improve the quality of life that we need to improve here on the West Bank.
So the monies that were deobligated by Councilman Kerner, have they been obligated in other places yet?
I think the only money that was new was
the $250,000 given to the Terry Town facade program.
I was able to put $250,000 into that program along with Vincent Cox. That's an important program for Terry Town. But as of yet, none of the money that was taken back from Gretna has been reallocated. You know, hopefully we'll go to like Park D for Me or Baratown Boulevard or, you know, the homeless problem we have here, but that remains to be seen.
Now, I know, talk to us. There's a couple of other major projects. There's I guess you call it a travel baseball park. I think they're even talking about having the possibility of housing out there that's right behind the golf course. the TPC or on back in that part is I think the West Bank Expressway is due for a big improvement project as well, right?
Correct. If, you know, good things. This session in Baton Rouge, we're able to help really fund some projects that are going to really help the West Bank. One is the a $45 million ballpark, travel ballpark that's almost finished. It's in its final stages. That's going to really bring baseball tourism, travel ball tourism, whatever it is, to that area in Avondale. You got the NOLA Motorsports there. You got the Westwego, the Swamp Tours, the Gator Town, all that's in Westwego and at Avondale. That's going to really grow. You're going to see that in the future. I'm excited about, we have $8 million set aside to have the improvements under the expressway. Hopefully, it will be like the Veterans Boulevard improvements to some extent. We're going to redo all the lights from Avondale all the way to Terry Parkway. We replace all those lights, and underneath the expressway, we're going to have landscaping improvements from Terry Parkway all the way to Avondale through Westwego. So it's all good. There's also a project that not too many people know about. It's called the Wharf Project in Westwego. It's the old Westwego Airport. It's over the levee. It's where the seaplanes used to land. And Mayor Billiard and his council are developing or building a area where the disabled can go and experience the swamp, go fishing, kayaking. It'll be all set, modified and built for the disabled folks who typically can't get out there. So that's a good thing that's going to be coming online soon. And you got to give kudos to Mayor Billiard and his team for pushing that.
When you look back upon this legislative session, what would you say, separate and apart from what you were able to bring back to Jefferson Parish, what would you say are some of the highlights of the session?
You know, the insurance, auto insurance and homeowners insurance. We've given what the insurance companies asked for. 90% of what they asked for, they got. And now it's time for them to deliver. They got to cut rates. They got to lower their rates. And let's see if that's going to happen. But every year it appears it's more and more. We need more for the insurance companies. But do we see the results? I haven't. Hopefully this is will change that. That's one of the biggest things that as a senator I hear about. We got to lower insurance rates. And the other thing in my district I'm dealing with is that Belchase Bridge. That is a terrible deal for those folks in Plaquemines Parish. Whoever wrote that contract for that state, in my opinion, committed malpractice. It's that bad. And people are starting to see that because they're getting bills for just going back and forth to their homes every day. And it's still not fixed. The toll system is still broke. There's no center for the folks to go to when there are complaints. The call center, the complaint center is in Golden Meadow. So we're trying to move that to Belchase and give those folks some relief.
Was that a public-private project?
It was a public-private partnership, but only one bidder. And there was really no input by the citizens of Plaquemines Parish. They would just say, okay, here's the deal. You paid the bill. And now businesses are hurting. Restaurants are hurting because people don't want to travel across the bridge to pay $1.50. One way over a small bridge over a ditch almost is crazy. So that's what we got to we have hearings coming up in Baton Rouge on August 19th, and we've been having hearings, and we've been screaming and hollering to the governor that this needs to be looked at and changed if at all possible.
And there were construction problems with that bridge as well. Is that correct?
Yeah, when it was first built, it was supposed to be built about a year ago, finished a year ago, but the approaches were sinking. And the excuses we've gotten, it's soft land in Louisiana. And it, I said, well, right next to it was a bridge in position for 60 years. There was no problem with the approaches. So they had to go rebuild, tear out the approaches, put in new foundations. During the second attempt, they got it right. So, but the first attempt, it wasn't correct. That was just one of the problems with it.
In talking with the insurance commissioner, Pat, when we're visiting with Senator Pat Connick, Pat, there's still a desire to have a special session on insurance, to pivot back to insurance real quick. Your thoughts about that?
I don't think so. I don't want to go back. We did enough. Let's see. We gave the insurance companies enough that they asked for. And I really don't want to go back to Baton Rouge and revisit that issue. Let's see if what we did will make some results, some good changes.
Yeah.
And the changes
final
being
thoughts?
The lower insurance rates. No, I think we got to have it. We did a great job in Baton Rouge, bringing some money back to Jefferson Parish on the West Bank specifically. Cameron Henry was a big help with that. So was the governor. But we got to work as a unit. Got to work as a team. We got to help Gretna, Oswego, Lafitte, and all of Marrero, Harvey. And if we work together, come together, and we can be a better parish for sure.
No doubt about it. Pat Connick, State Senator, thank you so much for joining us. Have a great week.
Thank you, Newt. Bye.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. It was a great article by Dan McLaughlin in a National Review that was posted this morning. And it's about, and he points out how there are a couple of theories of government, and that funding ideological projects and activism is okay. But it's not okay to defund. And he says that we keep returning to this theme. And the implicit and sometimes explicit premise is that this is all well and good for government to be ideological and political when we're funding things. Of course, most of this runs to the left, but not to defund it. That's actually a complete inversion, really, of, he says, of how the founders saw the nature of government funding. In fact, he quotes James Madison in Federalist 58. The beating heart of representative government is the power of Congress to simply not choose to fund things. Madison says, the House of Representatives can not only refuse, but they alone can propose the supplies requisite for the support of government. They, in a word, hold the purse, that powerful instrument by which we behold. In the history of the British Constitution, an infant and humble representation of the people gradually enlarging the sphere of its activity and importance, and finally reducing as far as it seems to have wished. All the overgrown prerogatives of the other branches of the government, this power over the purse may in fact be regarded as the most complete and effectual weapon with which any constitution can arm the immediate representatives of the people for obtaining a redress of every grievance and for carrying into effect every just and salutary measure. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. Folks, when we return after the top of the hour news break, we'll visit with Rafael Goyeneche, President, Metropolitan Crime Commission. We'll talk about a racketeering case. We'll talk about the criminal district court finding the sheriff in contempt. And we'll also talk about an NOPD investigation leak. We'll be right back with Rafael Goyeneche. Stay with us.